fat man in the camouflage trousers get up from his chair again. He's speaking on his phone as he sets off towards them. The woman in the studded collar is standing in the doorway leading to the stage, holding the curtain open. She seems to be hesitating about whether to come in or not. Behind her, Yuna can see a tall figure in a yellow oilskin coat, the sort fishermen used to wear. At first, he doesn't understand how he knows that he's staring at the preacher, but his mind suddenly brings a moment from the past into sharp focus. "Eric," Yuna says quietly, "the preacher is here. He's standing over there by the curtain in a yellow raincoat." The woman in the studded collar waves to someone and stumbles into the room. The beads of the curtain swing back and sway in front of the yellow figure. And now Yuna remembers how Philip Kronstedt described the man who was filming Maria Karlsson. The last thing he heard before he collapsed in the storeroom was that the thin man with the camera was wearing yellow oilskins, like the fishermen in Lofoten. Yuna starts walking, but the man in the camouflage trousers steps round the flowery sofa and stops him.
"I have to ask you and your friend to come with me," he says.
"Eric," Yuna says, "you saw him, didn't you? Over there by the curtain. That's the preacher. You have to follow him. Try to get a look at his face."
"This club is for members only," the man says.
"We were thinking of buying a sofa," Yuna says, as he sees Eric hurry away towards the curtain. Chapter 86. The fat man shouts at him to stop, but Eric carries on, weaving quickly between the sofas. The man yells at Yuna to move out of the way. An armchair gets shoved backwards, making a scraping sound on the floor.
"Pidan antiksi,"
Yuna says in Finnish, stopping him again. The man brushes Yuna's hand away, steps back, and pulls out a projectile taser.
"Nietse pian satu,"
Yuna goes on with a smile. He takes a step forward, sliding out of the line of fire, pushes the taser aside with his hand, and kicks the man in the knee, making his leg buckle. The man gasps, and two projectiles with spiral wires slam into the back of a sofa. Yuna twists the taser out of the man's hand and hits him in the collarbone with it, then wraps the wires round his neck and pulls. The man collapses to the floor, rolls over, and tries to get up again. Yuna forces him back down with his foot, winds the wires round his hand, and pulls them tighter until the man loses consciousness and slumps to the floor. Eric disappears through the bead curtain beside the stage. The door of the staff room at the other end of the room opens. A broad-shouldered man in a shiny jacket emerges with a phone to his ear and looks round. Yuna sits down to stay out of sight, but knows he has to stop the man from going after Eric. Rocky still has his eyes closed, but he's now got a cigarette between his lips. The prostitute with the studded collar pushes a used tissue between the cushions of a sofa and walks over to Yuna in her high heels.
"Shall we go to a room? I can show you a good time," she says, moving closer.
"Stay out of the way,"
he replies abruptly. She wipes her mouth and starts to walk towards the beaded curtain. The man in the shiny jacket has seen Yuna. He heads towards him, pushing a chair over as he approaches. Yuna stands up and sees that the man is hiding a weapon by his hip, a high-caliber pistol with a short barrel. The fat man is lying on his back, untangling the wires from his neck, coughing and trying to get up. The man in the shiny jacket stops in front of Yuna with the flowery sofa between them and screws a silencer onto his Sieg Pro.
"I'll shoot you in both knees unless you come with me," he says.
Yuna holds up one hand in a calming gesture and tries to back away, but the fat man on the floor grabs hold of his legs. "I didn't know this was a private club," Yuna says, trying to pull his legs free. The armed man has finished fitting the silencer, raises the gun and squeezes the trigger. Yuna throws himself aside, lands on his shoulder and hits his temple on the floor. There's no sound as the gun goes off, but the powder is hanging in the air, and a naked man behind Yuna stands up with blood streaming from a bullet hole in his stomach. A woman screams and hurries to move away from him and falls on all fours. "Time to die," the man with the gun pants, climbing up on the sofa to see over the back of it. Yuna grabs hold of the toppled lamp and swings the heavy base in a semicircle. It hits the man in the shoulder and he staggers to one side. The cable clatters on the floor as it snakes along behind. The man leans against the back of the sofa and Yuna reaches him before he has time to fire, knocking the pistol aside and punching him squarely in the throat. He grabs the warm barrel of the gun and feels a heavy blow to his cheek as he bends the weapon upwards. The man recoils, clutching his throat. He can't breathe, and saliva is dribbling from his gaping mouth. Yuna takes a step back as he twists the gun round and shoots the man through his right lung. The only sound is a sharp click instead of a loud bang. The empty shell bounces off the cement floor. The man staggers, trying to cover the entry hole with his hand, coughs, then slumps back onto the sofa. The fat man gets unsteadily to his feet with a knife in his hand. One of his shoulders is drooping, and the taser is still dangling from the wires around his neck. Yuna moves away and glances quickly towards the bead curtain. The man takes a couple of steps and jabs with the knife. Yuna backs into a table as he feels the tip of the blade touch his jacket. He follows the knife as it moves, holds it aside with the pistol, twists his body, and rams his right elbow into the man's cheek with immense force. His head snaps sideways, spraying droplets of sweat in the direction of the blow. Yuna moves with him, takes a long stride to keep his balance, and feels a stab of pain from his hip. As the man slumps unconscious to the floor, Yuna moves out of the way and scans the room. Very soon it will be impossible to get out. Crouching down, Yuna moves towards the curtain with the pistol pointing at the floor. The new customer who bought heroin from Anatoly is lying lifeless beside his sofa. His lips are grey and his eyes open. Yuna steps round a low glass table and sees the woman in the studded collar heading towards him between the sofas.
"Take me away from here with you," she whispers with a desperate look in her eyes. "Please, I'm begging you. I have to get away from here."
"Can you run?" She smiles at him and then her head suddenly jerks. A cascade of blood squirts from her temple. Yuna spins round as a bullet slams into the back of the chair next to him and stuffing sprays out across the floor. The man with the grey moustache is approaching between two women with a raised pistol. Smoke rising from the barrel. Yuna takes aim, lowers the barrel a couple of millimeters, then fires three times. It sounds like the gun isn't loaded, but a cloud of blood explodes behind the man. The man takes another two steps before collapsing on top of the two women, dropping his pistol and putting his hand out towards a footstool. The woman in the studded collar is still standing. Blood is pumping from her temple and running down her body. She looks at Yuna, and her mouth opens as if she's trying to speak.
"I'll get help," he says. Bewildered, she touches her bloody hair, then falls sideways onto an armchair and curls up as if she wants to sleep.
In the distance, a round-shouldered man is approaching at a crouch, using the sofas as cover. Yuna runs the last part of the way. A bullet hits the wall beside him, throwing out a shower of plaster. He ducks through the curtain, tucks his gun close to his body, and walks as fast as he can towards the passageway. A fat man is dancing on the stage with his shirt outside his trousers. There's no sign of Eric, and Yuna starts running as soon as he reaches the narrow corridor. He can hear his pursuers behind him as he enters the changing room and quickly locks the door. Someone is in the shower, and the plastic tray creaks with their weight. Yuna runs past two women standing in front of the makeup table. In the kitchen, a short man is frying frozen meatballs on the stove. He barely has time to snatch up a knife before Yuna shoots him in the thigh. The man falls to the floor, and Yuna hears him scream as he runs across the old cardboard boxes in the waste storage room and emerges out of the back of the building. He runs round the warehouse as fast as he can, through tall weeds, then out through the gates, along a barbed wire fence, and round a van before he sees that Eric's car has gone. He sets off at a limp towards Högdalsplan to alert the police and emergency services. Chapter 87. There's barely any traffic, and Eric is taking care to keep a safe distance between him and the car in front, all the way through the industrial estate and up onto Elfsjövägen. The preacher is driving a blue Peugeot, which is so dirty it's impossible to see what the registration number is. Eric has no other plan beyond following it as long as he can without being seen. The amber glow of the streetlights fills the car, then vanishes between the lampposts like slow breathing. Eric wonders if the preacher was at the zone to buy drugs or to meet Rocky. Concern about what has happened to Yuna flutters in his chest. Eric didn't look back, just did what he had to do. He left the room full of addicts, passed through the bead curtain, and carried on through the crowd. The heavy bass of the music grew louder as the beat was turned up and the throb of the music reached deep inside his body. In the flickering light from the stage, he suddenly caught sight of the yellow raincoat. The preacher was heading for the exit, and Eric followed him. A woman tried to stop him, but he just shook his head and forced his way past. No one gave him a second glance as he passed the search area and hurried on through the metal door and out onto the loading bay. Yuna seemed so sure of what he had said that the only thing on Eric's mind was that he mustn't lose the preacher now that they were so close. The yellow oilskin glinted in the darkness over by the cars, and Eric followed as quickly as he could without being heard. The preacher walked out through the gates and stopped in front of the blue car. He has now been following the red taillights for a quarter of an hour, and keeps telling himself that he mustn't let too much of a gap form. He speeds up a little on a long straight past a bare grit football pitch and a school. The sparse lights of a large housing estate flicker through the greenery. A night bus pulls out from a stop, and Eric has to slow down. He loses sight of the preacher, puts his foot down, and overtakes the bus on the wrong side of a central reservation. A set of traffic lights ahead turns red. Eric speeds up, swerves, and just makes it past the back of a car crossing his path. It's already too late, though, as he realizes that the blue Peugeot has turned off to the right. He sees its lights flickering between the houses. There's no time to think if he isn't to lose the preacher altogether. Eric turns into the next road, and in the boot a bag of empty bottles for recycling falls over. He's trying to double-guess the other car's likely direction as he drives past lush gardens and dark houses. He brakes and turns left, glancing the side of a letterbox and accelerating hard past a number of villas, then realizes that there's a dead end up ahead, beyond the next junction, and brakes hard, sending the tires skidding across the tarmac, jerks the wheel and swerves sharply to the right. The back wheels lose their grip and there's a crash as the rear wing hits an electricity pole. The bottles in the boot shatter as Eric lurches out onto the main road again. He accelerates hard up a hill, reaches the top, and just manages to spot the preacher driving into the tunnel under the motorway bridge. He slows down and feels his hands shaking on the steering wheel. The wing mirror has come loose again and is dangling from its wires. Someone has sprayed the words, "Another world is possible," on the concrete walls of the tunnel. Everything goes dark. Then, a moment later, he emerges into an area of attractive four-story buildings. The blue Peugeot passes a bin lorry emptying dustbins with measured mechanical movements, and Eric wonders if the preacher lives here in Herkmussen. Even though he has a reasonable grasp on reality, the idea of the preacher having an ordinary life seems incredible. A man who stabs knives into the faces of his victims long after they are dead, then goes home to his lovely villa with apple trees and lawn sprinklers and sits down to watch television with his family. Eric follows the blue car as it turns right off Korpmussewegen and into Klensmiedswegen. The preacher slows down and stops just after the third side street. Without changing his speed, Eric drives past the blue car and looks in the rearview mirror as the light inside the car goes out. He passes a small patch of woodland, turns into the next road, stops and hurries back. The yellow raincoat is disappearing into the forest to the left of the road, and Eric stops on the pavement and realizes how badly his legs are shaking. Chapter 88. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is located on Järfällevägen next to a large tarmacked car park. It's a low building with a terracotta-colored facade, paneled roof, and a red tower rising from the center of a circular stone foundation. Stake president Thomas Appel lives with his wife and two children in a cement gray villa very close to the temple. From the garden's wooden decking, with its covered barbecue, the red tower is visible above the trees and tiled roofs. Adam and Margot are sitting in the living room with glasses of lemonade. Thomas Appel and his wife Ingrid are sitting opposite them. Thomas is a skinny man dressed in grey trousers, a white shirt and a pale grey tie. His face is clean-shaven and thin, with fair eyebrows and a narrow, crooked mouth. Margot has just asked Thomas where he was at the times of the murders, and he's replied that he was at home with his family. "Is there anyone else who could vouch for that?" Margot asks, looking at Ingrid. "Well, of course, the children were at home," Thomas's wife says in an amiable voice. "No one else?" Adam asks. "We lead a quiet life," Thomas replies, as if that explained everything. "You have a lovely home," Margot says, glancing round the smart room. An African mask is hanging on the wall, next to a painting of a woman in a black dress with a red book in her lap. "Thank you," Ingrid says.
"Each family is a kingdom," Thomas says. "Ingrid is my queen, the girls' princesses."
"Naturally," Margot smiles. She looks at Ingrid's face, free of makeup, at the small pearls in her earlobes, and the long dress that reaches up to her neck and halfway over her hands.
"You probably think we dress in a very old-fashioned, boring way," Ingrid says when she sees Margot looking.
"It looks nice," Margot lies, and tries to find a comfortable position on the deep sofa with crocheted antimacassars on the back. Thomas leans forward, pours more lemonade in her glass, and she thanks him soundlessly. "Our lives aren't boring," Thomas says calmly. "There's nothing boring about not using drugs or alcohol or tobacco or coffee or tea." "Why not coffee?" Adam asks. "Because the body is a gift from God," he replies simply.
"If it's a gift, then surely you can drink coffee if you want to," Adam retorts.
"Of course it isn't set in stone," Thomas says lightly. "It's just guidance."
"Okay," Adam nods. "But if we listen to this guidance, the Lord promises that the angel of death will pass our home and not kill us."
Thomas smiles.
"How quickly does the angel come if you mess up badly?" Margot asks.
"You said you wanted to look at my diary," Thomas says, the veins in his temples darkening slightly.
"I'll get it," Ingrid volunteers and rises to her feet.
"I'll just get some water," Margot says, and follows her.
Thomas makes a move to stand up, but Adam stops him by asking about the role of the stake president. Ingrid is standing at a bureau looking for the diary when Margot walks into the immaculately tidy kitchen.
"Could I have some water?" Margot asks.
"Yes, of course," Ingrid says.
"Were you here last Sunday?"
"Yes,"
the woman replies, and a tiny frown appears across the bridge of her nose.
"We were at home."
"What did you do?"
"We did the usual. We had dinner and watched television."
"What was on television?" she asks.
"We only watch Mormon television,"
Ingrid says, checking that the tap is properly turned off.
"Does your husband ever go out alone in the evening?"
"No."
"Not even to the temple?"
"I'll have a look in the bedroom,"
the woman says, her cheeks flushing as she leaves the kitchen. Margot drinks, then puts the glass down on the worktop and goes back out to the living room. She can see the tension in Adam's face and a tiny hint of sweat above his top lip.
"Are you on any medication?" Adam asks.
"No,"
Thomas replies, wiping his palms on his pale grey trousers.
"No psychoactive drugs? No antidepressants?" Margot asks, sitting down on the sofa again.
"Why do you want to know that?"
he asks, looking at her with calm, blank eyes.
"Because you received treatment for mental illness 20 years ago. That was a difficult time for me, before I listened to God."
He falls silent and looks warmly at Ingrid, who's just come back in. She's standing in the doorway with a red Philofax in her hand. Margot takes the book, puts on her reading glasses, and starts leafing through the dates.
"Do you have a video camera?"
Adam asks, as Margot skims through the diary.
"Yes,"
he replies, with a quizzical look at Adam.
"Can I take a look at it?"
Thomas's Adam's apple bobs above the knot of his tie.
"What for?"
he asks.
"Just routine,"
Adam replies.
"Okay, but it's being repaired."
Thomas smiles, stretching his crooked mouth.
"Where?"
"A friend's mending it for me," he says softly.
"Can I have the name of the friend, please?"
"Of course,"
Thomas murmurs, and Adam's phone rings inside his jacket.
"Excuse me,"
he says, standing up and looking for his mobile as he turns his back on Thomas. Through the window at the back, he sees a neighbor standing on the other side of the fence looking at them. In the reflection, he can also see himself, his thick hair and heavy eyebrows. He finds his phone. Ade, an IT technician with National Crime, who also happens to live in Herkmusen.
"Adam,"
he says as he answers.
"Another film!"
Ade practically screams.
"We'll be there as soon as..."
"It's your wife on the video! It's Katrina!"
Adam doesn't hear anything after that. He walks straight into the hall, leans against the wall, and manages to pull down a framed photograph of two smiling girls.
"Adam,"
Margot calls. What's going on? She leaves the book on the sofa, stands up, and accidentally knocks over a glass of lemonade on the low table. Adam has already reached the front door. Margot can't see his face. She feels sick, clutches her stomach, and follows him out. Adam runs down the path to the car. He's started the engine before she's even out of the door. She stops, panting for breath, and watches him rev the engine, perform a sharp U-turn in the road, skid, and drive into a hockey goal that some children have erected on the side of the road. She walks down to the road and is gesturing for him to stop when her phone rings. Chapter 89. The house at Bultwegen 5 only has 3 rooms, but the kitchen has a nice dining area and there's a basement and a small garden that backs onto a patch of forest. They bought it fairly cheaply and were able to move closer to the city, but the house won't make it through many more winters without some serious renovation work. Katrina Youssef is sitting on the white sofa in front of the television. She's wearing her soft blue Hollister sweatpants and a pink T-shirt. She knows the varnish on her new nails dried a long while ago, but she still spreads her fingers out as she reaches for her glass of wine. Seeing as Adam isn't home, she's taken the opportunity to do her nails. Otherwise, he goes out and sits in the car to avoid getting a headache. She takes a sip, then looks down at the iPad in her lap. Caroline hasn't updated her status yet. She hasn't said anything for an hour now, and she can't have been in the shower all that time, surely. Katrina is watching an old film called Face Off on television, but is finding it rather far-fetched. She's got to work tomorrow, so shouldn't really sit up and wait for Adam. I'm not going to either, she thinks, and glances at the window as a bush in the garden brushes hard against the glass. She slips her hand inside her loose sweatpants and starts to masturbate, shuts her eyes for a few seconds, then stares out at the garden through the window, still masturbating, but stops when it occurs to her that their neighbor might bring back the rake he borrowed earlier that evening. She can't be bothered to close the curtains, and anyway, she's more bored than horny. Katrina yawns and scratches her ankle. Even though she ate a tuna salad earlier, she's hungry again. She carries on looking at the iPad, scrolls back and reads her own comments, then writes another one. With peculiar persistence, she looks at the latest pictures of Caroline Vindberger, the woman she's practically stalking. Caroline was discovered on an underground train on her way to football practice and is now a supermodel. It's rumored that she won't get out of bed for less than $25,000. Katrina follows her on all the forums there are and always knows where she is and what she's doing. It's just turned out that way. She reaches for the glass of wine again and shivers when she realizes that the garden lights aren't working. The bushes look black against the glass. She's not sure if the lights have worked at all that evening. It's not the first time they've gone wrong. Adam will have to check the fuse box. There's no way she's going down into the cellar, not after the break-in. She sees her own reflection in the dark window, drinks some more wine, and looks at her nails. Someone broke in last Thursday when she and Adam were both at work, and now the lock on the cellar door is broken. They've tied a piece of rope around it so it feels locked if you pull it. Nothing of value was stolen, not the home cinema center, the stereo, or games console. Maybe they realized that Adam is in the police and changed their minds. It's possible that they saw his framed diploma from the police academy and got out as fast as they could. Adam thinks it was just some bored youngsters. But it's still a bit odd, Katrina thinks. They could have taken their whiskey and wine, or her jewelry. The Prada clutch bag that Adam gave her 2 years ago was lying out in the bedroom. She's only discovered one missing object, a little cloth embroidered by her grandmother. Adam doesn't believe her. He reckons it will turn up and refused to mention it in the police report. Lamassu, the protective deity that her grandmother embroidered in pale red thread on white fabric, has always sat on the bookcase next to the silver crucifix on a stand. Katrina knows that someone has taken it. When she was little, she didn't like the embroidery at all. Her mum said that Lamassu watched over their home, but she could only see a monster. The close-stitched cloth depicted a man with a plaited beard, with the body of a bull and enormous angel's wings arching out from his back. Once again she thinks of the rope that Adam wound round the handle of the cellar door and then tied to the water pipe leading to the washing machine. She's made him look through the house several times. Apart from the cellar, the part of the house she finds creepiest is the large cleaning cupboard between the living room and the kitchen. It's like a dressing room with two unusually thick wooden doors. It used to be locked from the outside with a revolving wooden catch, but that's come loose. Now she and Adam just push the doors shut. But they move, rubbing against each other and opening slightly as if someone's trying to peer out. A car's headlights reflect off the gilded icon on the bedroom wall, then the glass covering Adam's framed match jersey. Every home has its creepy corners, she thinks with a shudder. Rooms and corners that have stored up childhood fears of the dark over the ages. She drinks the last of the wine and gets up to go to the kitchen. Chapter 90. Katrina moves the wine box to the edge of the worktop, then fills her glass under the little tap, splashing some tiny red droplets on her hand. The wind is rattling the kitchen air vent. Through the glass door, she can see the empty street through the branches of the viburnum. The two wooden doors of the cleaning cupboard in the hall leading to the living room knock against each other, then close tighter. She puts her glass down on an advert from Sephora, sucks the drops of wine from the back of her hand, looks at the glass, at the blonde woman on the flyer, and decides to keep the baby and not go through with the abortion. Katrina leaves her wine glass in the kitchen, thinks that she should send Adam a text message, telling him she's changed her mind. She walks slowly, keeping her eyes on the heavy wooden doors the whole time. She feels almost compelled to look at them, and stops when the far one starts to open slightly. Katrina takes a deep breath and hurries past. She forces herself not to run, but can feel the movement of the door as a shiver down her spine. She sits on the sofa and carries on watching the film. John Travolta has swapped faces with Nicolas Cage, but they just look like themselves. She can't help thinking about their neighbor. He gave her a funny look when he borrowed the rake, and she wonders if he knew she was at home on her own. Her iPad has gone dark, and she puts her finger on the screen and finds herself pointing straight at Caroline's smiling face when the screen comes back to life. Katrina knows that if she turns her head to the left, she can see the cupboard doors reflected in the window at the back of the house. She needs to stop this. It's turning into an obsession. What if it was their neighbor who broke in and stole the cloth and a pair of her pants from the washing basket? If you knew that the cellar door was only held shut by a rope, you could get in without making any noise at all. Katrina stands up and goes over to the window and is drawing the curtains when she thinks she can see someone running across the grass. She leans closer. It's hard to see in the dark. A deer. It must have been a deer, she thinks, and closes the curtain with her heart pounding. She sits down on the sofa, switches the television off, and starts to text Adam. In the middle of a sentence, her phone rings, scaring her so much that she jumps. She doesn't recognize the number.
Katrina?
She says warily. Hello, Katrina, a man says quickly. I'm one of Adam's colleagues at National Crime, and he's not... Listen now, the man interrupts. Are you at home?
Yes, I'm...
Go to the front door and leave the house. Don't worry about clothes or shoes. Just go straight out into the street and carry on walking.
Can I ask why?
Are you on your way out?
I'm going now.
She stands up and starts to walk through the room, looking towards the cupboard doors as she goes round the sofa and turns towards the front door. A person wearing yellow rain clothes is standing on the doormat with their back to her, closing the front door behind them. Katrina quickly moves backwards, goes round the corner and stops.
There's someone in here, she whispers. I can't get out.
Lock yourself in somewhere and leave your phone on.
God, there's nowhere to...
Don't speak unless you absolutely have to. Go to the bathroom. She's walking on unsteady legs towards the kitchen when she sees that the doors to the cleaning cupboard have slid open slightly. She can't think straight and opens one of the doors, slips quickly inside and stands beside the vacuum cleaner and pulls the door closed behind her. It's hard to close it properly when her fingers won't fit in the gap. She tries to get hold of the edge with her nails and pull it towards her. Katrina holds her breath when she hears footsteps outside the cupboard. They move off in the direction of the kitchen. The doors knock against each other. The other door slips open a couple of millimeters. She stands in the darkness with her eyes open wide and hears a kitchen drawer being opened. There's a metallic clattering sound and she's breathing in short gasps. And suddenly thinks about the relic in the church in Södertälje. Adam didn't want to go in with her, but she went and looked at it anyway. It was a fragment of bone belonging to Thomas, one of the apostles. The priest claimed that the Holy Spirit was still present in the relic, in the yellow fragment of bone inside the glass tube on the marble table. She reaches out her hand and tries to close the door, but can't get any grip. Her nails just slide over the wood. She moves carefully to the side, but the mop and bucket are in the way. The handle of the mop touches her winter coat, and a few empty hangers rattle softly on the rail. She manages to pull the door closed, but loses her grip again. It swings open slightly, and she can see a dark figure standing right outside the cupboard. Chapter 91. The door is yanked open, and a man with a pistol steps backwards. His mouth is half open, and his dark brown eyes are staring at her. A smell of sweat reaches her. She registers every detail at that moment. His worn jeans with turned-up cuffs, the grass stain on his right knee, his padded black nylon jacket, and the logo of the New York Yankees sewn badly onto his cap. "I'm a police officer," he says in a gasp, and lowers his gun.
"Oh, God," she whispers, and feels tears begin to flow.
He takes her hand and leads her towards the hall as he reports back to control on his radio.
Katrina is unharmed, but the suspect fled through the kitchen door. Yes, get the roadblock set up and send some dog units over here.
She walks beside the police officer, leaning her hand against the wall, brushing against her diploma from her makeup course.
Give me a moment, the officer says, and opens the front door to secure their exit.
Katrina bends down to put her trainers on, as a cascade of blood sprays across the hall mirror. Then she hears the sharp crack of the gun and the echo from the house on the other side of the road. The plainclothes officer throws his arm out, manages to grab the coats, and pulls them with him as he falls. He collapses on his back among the shoes. The hangers rattle as blood pulses from the bullet hole in his black jacket.
"Hide," he gasps. "Go and hide again."
Two further shots ring out, and Katrina moves backwards. Someone is screaming like an animal outside. She stares at the wounded police officer and at the blood seeping along the cracks in the tiled floor. A window pane shatters as another shot echoes through the neighborhood. Katrina runs at a crouch through the living room, slipping on the Tabriz rug and hitting her shoulder against the wall. But she manages to keep her balance, carries on out into the passageway, and opens one of the cleaning cupboard doors. The mop handle falls out, pulling the red bucket with it, and the strainer comes loose and clatters to the floor. Katrina picks the mop up and tries to get it to stand up among the clothes. A jacket falls down, and the thick hose of the vacuum cleaner pushes the other door open. She hears two more shots, leaves the cupboard, and carries on towards the kitchen. She sees the glass door and the darkness outside, opens the cellar door, and starts to go down the steep staircase. She's so frightened she can barely breathe, and can only think that this is an organized, hate-based crime, that the racists have found them, that they're upset about Adam buying a new Jaguar. She can hear police cars through the stone walls and thinks that she can hide in the boiler room until the police have caught the intruder. Her anxiety increases as she heads down into the darkness. She clings onto the cool handrail, blinks and opens her eyes wide, but can hardly see a thing. The air smells of stone, damp pipes, and oil from the boiler. She's treading carefully, but the steps still creak under her weight. Finally, she reaches the tiled floor. She blinks and can make out the washing machine as a paler shape in the darkness next to the door with the rope around its handle. She turns round and moves in the opposite direction, past Adam's old pinball machine and into the boiler room. She carefully closes the door behind her and hears a whining sound. Katrina stands still with her fingers on the door handle, listening. The pipes are clicking faintly, but otherwise everything is quiet. She moves further in, away from the door, thinking that she'll just sit here. It won't be long, not now that the police have arrived. She hears the whimpering sound again, very close to her. She turns her head, but can't see anything. The whimpering becomes a weak, wheezing sound. It's coming from the safety valve of the hot water tank. Katrina feels her way forward and finds the paint-stained stepladder standing against the wall. She unfolds it in silence and moves it to the wall beneath the window up by the ceiling. Someone has stolen Lamassu, she thinks. The embroidered cloth with her protective deity, her protector, that's why this is happening. She can't stay in the house. She never wants to come back here again. She twists the two catches of the window and is pushing the little window against the weeds when she feels a cold draft around her ankles. Someone's coming up behind her. She's convinced of it. Someone's got in through the cellar door. They've cut the rope holding it closed and are on their way inside. It's impossible to open the window properly. She tries again, but it keeps hitting something. Panting for breath, she reaches out with her arm through the weeds and feels that the lawnmower is parked too close. She tries to push it away with her hand, pushing even though she can feel the stepladder slide backwards beneath her. She turns the wheel of the lawnmower by hand and manages to roll it a few centimeters. The window slides open and she starts to crawl out as the door to the boiler room bursts open and the light is switched on. The old starter switch makes the fluorescent tube flicker. Katrina tries to scramble out as the steps are yanked away from beneath her and clatter to the floor. Her legs thud against the wall, her knees sting, but she clings onto the frame and fights to pull herself up. The first stab of the knife hits her back so hard that she hears the point scrape the concrete wall in front of her. Chapter 92. Adam Youssef is lying on his stomach on the paved path outside his home with his hands cuffed behind his back. His thigh is throbbing, his black jeans are wet with blood, but the superficial gunshot wound doesn't really hurt. Blue lights from various vehicles are pulsing over the dark greenery of the garden in a peculiar rhythm. A police officer presses his knee into Adam's shoulder blades and yells at him to be quiet while he explains the situation to the operational team.
Katrina's still in there, Adam pants.
The operational lead officer is in direct contact with the head of the Stockholm Rapid Response Unit, trying to coordinate their efforts. The first team is forcing the windows and doors, securing entry and letting the paramedics through. The officer who has been shot is rolled out on a stretcher, while staff at the Karolinska Hospital in Huddinge have been warned to prepare for immediate sedation and an operation. Adam tries to pull free, but is struck so hard across the kidneys that he loses his breath. He coughs and feels the police officer pressing his knee against the back of his neck, grabbing his jacket and roaring at him to lie still.
I'm a police officer and shut up!
The second officer takes Adam's wallet, backs away slightly, and the gravel crunches beneath his shoes as he looks at Adam's police badge and ID.
National crime, he confirms.
The police officer removes his knee from Adam's back and stands up, breathing hard. As the pressure is removed from his neck and lungs, Adam catches his breath and tries to roll over onto his side.
You shot a plain-clothed police officer, the officer says. He had my wife. I saw her with him and thought he was the first officer on the scene, and he was on his way out with her. Everyone had received that information. Just get her out, Adam begs.
What the hell are you two doing?
A woman shouts. It's Margot. Adam sees her legs through the blackberry bushes by the road as she walks through the gate and stops.
He's a police officer, she says, and takes several shallow breaths. It's his wife who...
He shot a colleague, one of the officers says.
It was an accident, Adam says. I thought, don't say anything else, Margot interrupts.
Where's Katrina?
I don't know. I don't know anything. Margot,
I'm going in, she says, and he watches her feet move along the path.
Tell her I love her, he whispers.
Help him up, Margot tells the two officers, and get those handcuffs off. Put him in one of the cars for the time being.
She starts to walk towards the house with both hands round her stomach. A young man from the Rapid Response Unit comes out through the front door with his helmet in his hand. He passes Margot and throws up right across the front steps, then carries on down the garden path with a glazed look on his face. He unfastens his bulletproof vest and lets it fall to the ground, emerges onto the street and throws up again between two parked patrol cars, then leans on the bonnet of one of the cars and spits. The two officers take hold of Adam's arms, pull him up onto his feet, and lead him away from the house. He feels blood trickling down his thigh from the gunshot wound. They lead him off to a patrol car and sit him in the back seat, but leave the handcuffs on. Another ambulance passes the cordon and is waved forward by the police. Adam can hear the sharp clatter of a helicopter and looks towards the front door to see if Margot is coming out with Katrina. When the fourth video was received at National Crime, the system spun into action instantly, the way that it should. One of the technicians was a good friend of Adam Youssef. He recognized Katrina on the film and issued immediate emergency information on the National Crime Intranet, then called Adam. To save time and maintain tactical efficiency, a so-called special event was declared, and the various divisions within the police coordinated their efforts as rapidly as possible. The alarm was sounded on police radio covering the southern and western police districts, as well as the city centre, Nacka and Södertorn. The officer closest to Bultvägen 5 was a plainclothes detective rather than a patrol car. He was on the scene just 7 minutes after the video was received by the police. Chapter 93. It feels like an eternity before Adam sees Margot again. She's walking slowly, holding the handrail, then stops with her hand round her stomach. Her nose is pale and her forehead is shiny with sweat as she walks towards him out in the street. "Get those fucking handcuffs off," she says, with barely suppressed anger to the police officers. They hurry to free Adam. He massages his wrists and looks into her eyes, sees her dilated pupils, and feels a wave of nausea rise in his stomach. "What's going on?" he asks in a frightened voice. She shakes her head, comes closer, glances quickly towards the house, and then looks back at him again. "Adam, I'm sorry. I can't tell you how sorry I am."
"What for?"
he asks stiffly, opening the car door. "Sit down," she says. But he gets out of the car and stops in front of her with a peculiar feeling of being completely weightless. "Is it Katrina?" he asks. "Just tell me. Is she hurt?"
"Katrina's dead."
"I saw her in the doorway. I saw her."
"Adam," she pleads.
"Are you sure? Have you spoken to the paramedics?"
She hugs him, but he pulls free, takes a step back, and sees some heavy blackberries swaying on a thin branch.
"I'm so terribly sorry," she says again.
"You sure she's dead? I mean, the ambulance. What's the ambulance doing here?"
"If she's Katrina, we'll stay here until the forensic examination of the scene is complete."
"Is she in the hall? Can you tell me where she is?"
"In the boiler room. She must have hidden in the boiler room."
Adam looks at her, and the pain in his thigh is suddenly throbbing, all-encompassing. He watches all the police officers leave the house and gather for a debriefing over by the command vehicle. A flash of insight passes through his mind. His wife was almost safe, but he shot the police officer who was on his way out with her.
"I shot a colleague," he says.
"Don't think about that now. You're sleeping at mine tonight. I'll call the boss."
She tries to take hold of his arm, but he turns away.
"I need to be alone. Sorry, I..."
The helicopter is hovering a short distance away, over the sports ground, it looks like.
"Did they get the preacher?" he asks.
"Adam, we're going to get him. He's in the area. We're deploying everything we've got. Absolutely everything."
He nods a few times, then turns away again.
"Just give me a moment," he whispers.
Takes a few steps and picks at the branch of a bush.
"You have to stay here," Margot says.
Adam looks at her for a few seconds, then begins to wander slowly out into the garden. He's holding his face, pretending to try to absorb what she said, but he knows he needs to see Katrina, because he doesn't believe them. It can't be true. It isn't true. Katrina has nothing to do with this. Adam starts walking round the house. The green hose is lying in the unmown grass. A swarm of gnats is visible in the shimmering blue light. It gets darker when he reaches the back of the house. Adam sees himself as a black silhouette in the red dome of the round barbecue. He goes round the corner and sees that the cellar door is open. The rope has been cut. He goes inside. The lights are all on down there. He can hear people walking about upstairs. A forensics officer is laying out walking plates. Adam takes another step in, and that's when he sees Katrina in the cold neon light of the boiler room. She's sitting leaning against the boiler, and there's blood everywhere on her sweatpants, her vest, the floor. Her hair is tucked behind one ear, but most of her face is gone, hacked off. Dark blood glints across the whole of her ribcage, and her left hand appears to be squeezing the fingers of her right hand. Adam staggers backwards, hears the sound of his own breathing, knocks over a packet of washing powder, stumbles over his own Wellington boots, and emerges into the garden again. He's gasping for breath, but can't get enough air into his lungs and starts poking at his mouth. Nothing is comprehensible anymore. The alarm was sounded half an hour ago, and now everything is irrevocable. Adam turns to walk back and is just passing the compost heap when he hears a branch creak in the forest. An officer comes round the corner of the house and calls for him, but he carries on in amongst the trees, following the sound of someone moving in there. Behind him, the floodlights are switched on, flooding his home and garden with light. The trunks of the trees shine grey, as if they were covered by a layer of ash, as if he were in an underground forest. 20 meters in stands a man, looking at him. Their eyes meet between the gently glowing stems, and it takes Adam a few seconds to realize who the man in front of him is. The psychiatrist, Eric Maria Bark. It's like a lightning flash in his head when he realizes everything. Awareness hits him like an axe striking a block of wood. Adam reaches down and pulls the little pistol from his ankle. There's a rasping sound as the Velcro comes loose. He feeds a bullet into the chamber, raises the pistol, and fires. The shot hits the top of a branch in front of Eric's face and is deflected. Splinters fly up, and he sees the psychiatrist flinch. His hand is shaking. He tries to aim lower. The psychiatrist moves backwards, and he fires again. The shot simply disappears.